Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the January 19th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is how Marco Rubio went from Little Marco to Trump's foreign policy enabler by Dexter Filkins. Profiles: how Marco Rubio went from Little Marco to Trump's foreign policy enabler. As Secretary of State, the president's one-time foe now offers him lavish displays of public praise and will execute his agenda in Venezuela and around the globe, by Dexter Filkins. Just after midnight on January 3rd, as American commandos surged into Caracas to seize President Nicolas Maduro, large sections of the city went dark. Blackouts are common in Venezuela, but the blasts that followed confirmed the arrival of the United States military, which for weeks had kept thousands of troops poised offshore. The skies filled with helicopters, some skimming the rooftops, along with jet fighters and B-1 bombers. They had been dispatched to protect a Delta Force team heading to the Fuerte Tiona military complex, where Maduro and his wife were hunkered down. There, the commandos undertook an operation that they had spent months practicing at Fort Campbell in Kentucky. They shot their way past the defenses, and as the Maduros struggled to shut a heavy metal door, took them into custody. More than 50 of Maduro's guards were killed, but the Americans left nearly untouched. President Donald Trump told Fox News afterward that it was like watching a television show. At a press conference at Mar-a-Lago the morning after the attack, a similar sense of gleeful unreality prevailed. Trump boasted of an assault like people have not seen since World War II and said, "We're a respected country again, maybe like never before." But his account of the motivation for the attack shifted. For years, he and his supporters have maintained, with little public evidence, that Maduro was a narco trafficker on a global scale, bringing vast amounts of cocaine into the U.S. From the podium, Trump insisted that Maduro had waged a ceaseless campaign of violence, terror, and subversion against the United States, adding that he was responsible for hundreds of thousands of American deaths. Though Trump spoke of America's interest in safeguarding the good of the Venezuelan people, he mentioned the country's oil reserves, the largest in the world, no fewer than 20 times. "The infrastructure needed fixing," he said. "It's, you know, blow-up territory. Oil is very dangerous. It's a very dangerous thing to take out of the ground. We're going to be replacing it, and we're going to be taking a lot of money out so that we can take care of the country. Yeah." As Trump spoke, Marco Rubio, his Secretary of State, stood quietly behind him. When he was finally called to the microphone, Rubio began what has become a familiar routine, offering Trump the kind of adulation that is ordinarily reserved for heroes. "People need to understand that this is not a president that just talks and does letters and press conferences," he said. "If he says he's serious about something, he means it." He hailed Trump as not just a president of action, but also a president of peace. Rubio proceeded to the second phase of his routine, explaining that Trump's most flamboyant measures, in this case, the nighttime invasion of a sovereign state to capture its leader without congressional authorization, were in fact completely ordinary. "Nicolas Maduro was indicted in 2020 in the United States," he said. "He is not the legitimate president of Venezuela. That's not just saying it. He's not recognized by the European Union in multiple countries around the world." Rubio pointed out that the State Department had offered a $50 million reward for Maduro's arrest. Trump interrupted over his shoulder. "Don't let anybody claim it," he said. "Nobody deserves it but us." As Secretary of State and also National Security Advisor, Rubio is, at least in theory, the most powerful American diplomat since Henry Kissinger. But compared with Kissinger, whose crusading interventionism defined a generation of America's global relationships, Rubio often seemed like a supporter staffer for the president. As Trump lurches from one crisis to another, Rubio, calm, articulate, and capable of projecting a Boy Scout's earnest charm, justifies his policies, soothes rattled allies, and puts the best face on initiatives that only a few years ago he would have denounced. In the days after the attack on Venezuela, many observers made the inevitable comparison to Iraq, another oil-rich country where the U.S. toppled a strongman ruler, prompting a years-long quagmire. Rubio insisted in a series of appearances that the situations were not at all the same. On Face the Nation, he said, "A lot of people analyze everything that happens in foreign policy through the lens of what happened from 2001 through, 2015 or 16. This is not the Middle East, and our mission here is very different." Since Trump began his second term, his America First foreign policy has brought about an epochal change in the country's place in the world, as the U.S. casts off traditional commitments to pursue its immediate self-interest. The sprawling network of alliances, treaties, and foreign assistance programs that the U.S. built at the end of the Second World War is being radically altered or simply discarded. Since January, the U.S. has cut tens of billions of dollars in humanitarian and development aid, withdrawn from such landmark agreements as the Paris Climate Accord, and curtailed reporting on human rights abuses. Entire government departments have been hollowed out. In their place is a highly personalized approach, largely dependent on the whims of Trump, whose foreign policy reflects a harsher, stingier, and less forgiving country. Rubio, at 54, is the policy's unlikely executor. Before joining the Trump administration, he spent his career advocating for America as the leader of the world's democracies. The son of Cuban immigrants, he was a champion of aid to impoverished countries. Some observers believe that Rubio is working to provide consistency and balance in a tumultuous administration. He's doing his best to moderate Trump's worst impulses, a European foreign minister told me. He understands the stakes. He's whispering in Trump's ears. But he has only so much influence. Others are less charitable. They believe that Rubio is presiding over the remaking of America as a kind of rogue nation, just as an axis of authoritarian rivals, led by China, rises to challenge the world's democracies. Trashing our allies, gutting state and foreign aid, the tariffs, the damage is going to take years to repair, if it can ever be repaired. Eric Rubin, a retired ambassador who headed the State Department's diplomatic union, told me, "I hope it ruins his career." By most standards, Rubio occupies a privileged post. His desk in the White House is just a few steps from the Oval Office, but it is not the position that he hoped to occupy. In 2016, Rubio ran for president and lost to Trump in the primary. He now serves his former opponent, an unstable leader who regularly traduces institutions that Rubio spent his career supporting. Ultimately, he has to be 100% loyal to the president, and when the president zigs and zags, Rubio has to zig and zag too, a former Western diplomat told me. He's had to swallow a lot of shit. The election in 2016 is the only one that Rubio has ever lost, an anomaly and a carefully managed ascent. In 1999, he was elected to the Florida House of Representatives from a largely working-class area of West Miami. Though he didn't live in the district when the seat opened up, he moved there in time to campaign. Just 4 years later, he announced that he would run for Speaker of the House. Florida had recently imposed term limits, and many senior House members were retiring. The leadership was open, and Rubio wanted it. Many people in Florida politics felt that the time was right for a Cuban American speaker, but Rubio faced a difficult issue. For years, public school teachers in Florida's cities were paid more than those in rural areas to compensate for their higher cost of living. A powerful group of legislators, mostly from rural North Florida, wanted salaries equalized across the state. No candidate for speaker had supported the change. Gaston Cantins, a Cuban-American legislator who represented Miami, had refused to do so in the previous speaker race and ended up dropping out. But Rubio was amenable. The rural legislators got their formula, and in exchange they went with Marco, a former Senate senior Democrat in the legislature, told me. Cantins was a carcass on the side of the road. Rubio won. The Florida Bulldog, a regional newspaper, later calculated that the change had cost Miami teachers nearly $1 billion. The one constant in Marco Rubio's career is that he has betrayed every mentor and every principal he's ever had in order to claim power for himself, a political figure in Miami told me. In Florida, term limits make it harder for elected officials to acquire deep experience, and Rubio's legislative record is relatively thin. For his first address as speaker, he placed a book titled 100 Innovative Ideas for Florida's Future on every legislator's desk. The pages were blank. Rubio said he wanted to fill them with proposals gathered from voters. This effort resulted in a few dozen successful, though mostly marginal, pieces of legislation, including one that expanded scholarships for private school education and another that created an advisory committee to help make the government more efficient. Give him credit, a lobbyist working in Florida at the time told me. He didn't have a lot of ideas himself. It was a clever thing to do. The same day that Rubio presented his idea book, he was inaugurated as Speaker at the Capitol. He gave a speech that summoned the experience of a young single mother, arguing that the government had a moral obligation to help her secure a better life for her child. Governor Jeb Bush, a longtime booster, sat in the front row, moved to tears. "I can't think back to a time when I've ever been prouder to be a Republican, Marco," he said afterward. He handed Rubio a golden sword, explaining that it was the sword of a great conservative warrior, a reference to the anti-communist leader Chiang Kai-shek, who had been part of his family's folklore since George H.W. Bush served as a diplomat in China. Rubio hung the sword in the speaker's office. In his memoir, An American Son, he called Bush the man I most admired in Florida politics. In the memoir, Rubio wrote about the ambition that propelled him. "All my life, I've been in a hurry to get to my future. He has repeatedly evinced an instinct for seizing opportunities, sometimes in ways that angered his colleagues. He wrote that in pursuit of the speakership, he made a series of terrible blunders. In 2009, when his tenure as speaker had ended, Rubio announced that he would run for the U.S. Senate. He was 37 and mostly unknown statewide. His main opponent was Charlie Crist, who was finishing a term as governor. At one point, Crist was 30 points ahead in the polls, and Rubio considered dropping out. But Florida's Republicans were becoming more conservative, and the right-wing movement known as the Tea Party was gathering strength. Rubio adopted its platform, vowing to repeal Obamacare, lower taxes, and shrink the government. Crist's record in office made him vulnerable. He had governed as a moderate and endorsed an economic stimulus plan that Obama passed after the financial crisis of 2008. Nearly every Republican governor had willingly accepted money from the plan, but Rubio, like many Tea Party candidates, argued that it was bankrupting the country. A pro-Rubio ad showcased a moment when Crist embraced Obama at a public event, and Rubio gleefully talked about it in interviews. "Why would I hug someone I don't know?" he asked in one, smiling broadly with feigned bewilderment. Rubio captured the party's nomination, then the seat in the Senate. "Marco got lucky," a Republican lobbyist in Florida told me. "Charlie fucked himself. He governed from the left, which he could get away with, but then hugging Obama, Marco just jumped on him. In the Senate, Rubio was known as a serious legislator with an engaging manner. He was passionate about football, which he played in high school, and for a time in college, most mornings he worked out in the Senate gym. He wanted to be an NFL player, but he can't, so he's a politician. Alex Conant, who was the communications director for Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign, told me, "He approaches his life like an athlete does. Very disciplined, very competitive." A Senate staffer told me that Rubio often seemed like a different person in private. In closed hearings, he's funny and relaxed. The moment the doors open and the reporters come in, he changes. It's a little sad. Rubio is a crisp and polished speaker. During the 2016 presidential campaign, he was in demand on talk shows. The TV bookers always wanted him because whenever Marco came on, their ratings went up, Conant said. The charm didn't work on everyone. "He's a hard guy to get close to," a senator who knows Rubio told me. "After work, when we go out for a drink or a dinner, Marco never really went for that." A former Rubio staffer said that he was an introvert in a job that required relentless glad-handing. "He reads voraciously," the staffer said. "Most senators don't read." During the 2016 campaign, Rubio wrote his own speeches, a rarity among modern politicians, and worked his way through a volume of The Last Lion in which William Manchester depicts William Churchill in the years before he confronted Hitler. Rubio's focus was national security. He sat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and on the Intelligence Committee, which oversees America's spy agencies, including the CIA and the NSA. He got to travel a lot. Marco had never really left the U.S. "I think he went to Paris with his wife," a former advisor to Rubio said. The Senate helped him see the world. Rubio established himself as an heir to Ronald Reagan, who advocated relentless anti-communism, robust military force, and unapologetic support for human rights abroad. He always viewed domestic politics as political issues, as opposed to foreign policy, which he viewed as bipartisan and more serious, the former advisor told me. In 2014, after Russia invaded Crimea, Rubio gave an impassioned floor speech calling for a vigorous response, not just because the Ukrainians deserved help, but also because the invasion threatened the global order. "We cannot allow this to go unpunished, and I tell you that the only way that this can be punished is if the free countries of the world rally together and impose sanctions and costs for having taken this action on Vladimir Putin and on his cronies," he said. "And that will never happen unless the United States of America leads that effort." When there were elections at stake, though, Rubio proved more malleable. After Obama won a second term in 2012, GOP leaders concluded that they had to find a way to appeal to Latino voters, so they decided to soften the party's stance on illegal immigration. For years, efforts to reform the immigration system had ended in stalemate, with Republicans favoring tougher border security and Democrats wanting to legalize the millions of undocumented immigrants already in the country. Now, with Republicans signaling that they were open to compromise, a deal began to take shape. The senators leading the initiative, four Republicans and four Democrats, became known as the Gang of Eight. The Republicans included such veterans as John McCain and Lindsey Graham, but Rubio emerged as the most important among them. He was the group's lone Republican Latino, an articulate conservative from a state that had experienced waves of illegal immigration. GOP leaders saw him as a uniquely capable of selling the legislation in venues like Fox News. In 2013, he appeared on the cover of Time with the headline, "The Republican Savior." But opposition began to rise from the party's surging right wing. In the Senate, a young aide named Stephen Miller compiled a handbook of statistics and talking points to discredit the bill. On talk radio, Rush Limbaugh railed against welcoming illegals and said, It is all about expanding government, creating a power base that can never, ever lose. Even as the legislation headed for victory in the Senate, some House members started backing away. After Rubio made a trip to New Hampshire to assess his chances in a presidential campaign, he too withdrew his support. An all-or-nothing strategy on immigration reform would result in nothing, Conant, his spokesman, said at the time. After Rubio signaled his ambivalence, the bill died in the House. Rubio later insisted that he had abandoned the legislation because Democrats were trying to change it, but proponents of reform blamed him for the bill's failure. Frank Sherry, an immigration advocate, said, "If Rubio had stayed with it and provided leadership, if he'd had a backbone, we would have passed immigration reform." Rubio's Republican colleagues in the Gang of Eight were blunt about his prospects. "We don't need another young guy not quite ready," Graham said. "He's so afraid of the right." The failure of immigration reform did not deter Rubio, who soon declared that he would run for president in 2016. The decision put him in direct competition with Jeb Bush, his friend and mentor, a leading candidate at the time. Jeb fully expected that Marco would stand aside out of loyalty, a former Rubio associate told me, but Marco knew Jeb was not suited to the current moment. The friendship was ruptured, but the two have since made peace. Marco is the prodigal son, and Jeb always forgives him, someone who has worked with both men said. On the campaign trail, Rubio spoke of growing up in a family of Cuban immigrants. His father, Mario, who was a hard-working bartender. His mother, Aurelis, was a hotel maid. "You know what my parents achieved?" Rubio said at an event before the Florida primary. "They owned a home in a safe and stable neighborhood. They retired with dignity, and they left all four children better off than themselves. That's the American dream." But Trump, whose shameless venality was still a novelty in national politics, dominated the primary. Rubio's efforts to push back gave the campaign its most colorful moments. He savaged Trump as a con artist who was perpetuating the biggest scam in American political history. After Trump dubbed him Little Marco, Rubio countered by mocking his relatively small hands. And you know what they say about guys with small hands. His line about Trump's spray tan was arguably wittier. He should sue whoever did that to his face. Rubio publicly apologized for the crude remarks, explaining they had embarrassed his children. Yet even as he and Trump exchanged insults, they developed a friendlier rapport backstage, the former Rubio advisor told me. They would joke with each other when none of the other candidates would talk to Trump, because they thought he was too toxic or they just didn't like him. In the primary, Rubio lost every one of Florida's 67 counties except for his home base, Miami-Dade. He dropped out of the race in time to run for re-election to his Senate seat. He kept his distance from Trump, skipping the Republican convention and staying away when he came to Florida to campaign. "Everyone assumed Trump was going to lose anyway," Alex Conant told me. Instead, Trump won Florida and the presidency, and his victory transformed the GOP. Rubio won, too, and as he returned to the Senate, he remade himself as a Trump-style partisan. In 2021, after Trump refused to accept that Joe Biden had won the presidency, Rubio voted to certify the results, proclaiming that democracy is held together by people's confidence in the election. But as Trump insisted that he had won, Rubio began casting doubts on the election, baselessly alleging fraud in places like Wisconsin and Arizona. When Rubio released An American Son in 2013, he wanted to tell the sunny story of a child of immigrants who'd risen on the strength of hard work and family values. 10 years later, he published Decades of Decadence, How Our Spoiled Elites Blew America's Inheritance of Liberty, Security, and Prosperity. It was an angry book in which he excoriated the country's leaders, Republican and Democratic, for conspiring to destroy the working class by shipping jobs overseas while concentrating on identity politics and transgender rights. In foreign policy, Rubio advocated a more focused deployment of resources aimed at confronting China. The book is closely argued, but at times shrill and inconsistent. In one section, Rubio refers to the Biden administration as the most radical Marxist presidency that the country has ever seen. Elsewhere, he lauds the Paycheck Protection Program, a huge COVID relief bill that he helped design. Subsequent audits have found that the program, which cost more than $800 billion, was riddled with inefficiency and fraud. During Biden's term, nominees for senior posts often came before the Foreign Relations Committee for approval. According to a Senate staffer who regularly attended committee meetings, Rubio frequently allowed nominations to proceed without raising objections, then afterward recorded his vote as a no. Though his practice is not uncommon, Rubio seemed unusually intent on creating a record to show that he had resisted Biden's nominees. Over the course of 4 years, he did this hundreds of times, the staffer said. In Trump's first term, his foreign policy was a loosely articulated mix of positions and prejudices. Soon after taking office, he supplied Ukraine with sophisticated weapons to use against Russia. 6 months later, he held an inexplicably affectionate meeting with Putin in Helsinki, talking to him in private with no advisors in the room. He denounced America's European allies as freeloaders and delinquents, but he succeeded where his predecessors had failed in forcing them to spend more on their own defense. Trump came into his second term with a more substantial policy, much of it provided by the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. This vision was guided by two deep grievances. The first was that the U.S. was upholding international laws and alliances at the expense of ordinary citizens who pay taxes to sustain the country's overseas entanglements and who surrendered their children to its wars. The second was that America was being economically exploited. According to this idea, which most economists rejected, the U.S. was harmed by importing far more than it exported. Under Trump, America would focus on dominating the Western Hemisphere, leaving Eurasia to China and Russia. The goal of foreign policy would be not diplomacy, but commerce, enabled by tariffs on nearly all goods imported from foreign countries, friend or foe. Trump promised in his inaugural address, "From this day forward, our country will flourish and be respected again all over the world." Trump's attack on the status quo reflected a momentous change. The bipartisan consensus that had characterized American foreign policy since the Second World War was breaking apart. Defenders of the status quo noted that the post-war period was a time of unprecedented peace, free of the great power wars that had killed about 100 million people in the previous century. The era of American supremacy had also brought immense prosperity. In 2025, the U.S. accounted for roughly a quarter of the world's GDP. But America First proponents say that this account fails to acknowledge the societal and economic devastation that swept many parts of the U.S. Our country is a lot weaker in 2023 than it was, say, in 1983. Kevin Roberts, the head of the Heritage Foundation, told the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Roberts asserted that the American social order, measured by such things as marriage rates, had splintered, and that huge fiscal deficits meant that the country could soon literally be bankrupt. Rubio, in decades of decadence, offered his family as an economic benchmark. This country has undergone immense economic and social change since my parents first came to this country. Many of these changes have not been for the better. As the mood turned against foreign involvement, Tom Shannon was a mainstay at the State Department. Shannon was an archetypal foreign service officer, an Oxford graduate fluent in Spanish and Portuguese, who served as a diplomat for 34 years. including stints as ambassador to Brazil and during Trump's first term as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. You're listening to The New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Shannon told me that the disillusionment with the diplomacy began with the attacks of September 11, 2001, when the U.S. launched wars that went terribly wrong. We spent trillions of dollars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and all we got were dead kids, he said. And then if you add in the financial crisis, the heartland of the country was thrown into a deep malaise. Shannon drew a surprising comparison to the political upheavals of 1968. Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and eventually Cesar Chavez all came out against the Vietnam War. He said, they believe that the focus on pumping resources into these conflicts deflects us from addressing the political issues in our own country. Trump appealed to the MAGA base with a version of the same message, Shannon said. How much is it costing us? How many hospitals in the United States? How many schools? How many roads? How many free tuition universities could we have built instead? Some supporters understood this vision as anti-interventionist. In reality, it was hostile to anything that prevented America from securing quick results and to any alliance in which the U.S. didn't have the better end of the deal. Trump doesn't talk about Central Europe or Indochina, Shannon said. He talks about Canada, Greenland, and Panama, the United States as a regional hegemon that protects itself from attacks coming over the Arctic. That means the Canadians have to be locked in. And what better way to lock them in than make them the 51st state? In Greenland, you can't trust the Danes to do it. We're going to have such a fearsome military that nobody is going to mess with us. And it's not up to us to protect others. I told Shannon that this was the most lucid explanation of Trump's foreign policy I'd heard in months of reporting. That's part of the problem, he said. This is one of the most inarticulate administrations in American history. As the 2024 election approached, Rubio was on a short list of candidates for vice president. But unlike J.D. Vance, he didn't lobby for the job. The president kept saying, "Why doesn't he call me?" A Washington lawyer who speaks to Trump often told me. When Vance, who is not a natural retail politician, made a series of awkward statements during the campaigns, Trump sometimes mused that he would have been better off with Rubio. The White House denied this. The thing about Marco is he's very comfortable with the guys, the lawyer said. He's a guy's guy, which I think is why Trump likes him. When Rubio was nominated for Secretary of State, America First advocates were suspicious that he represented the vestiges of the old guard. Rubio was the neocon candidate in 2016. Kurt Mills, the editor of the American Conservative, told me. Nobody forgot that. But a senior White House official told me that Trump and Rubio were not as far apart on the issues as their 2016 campaign rhetoric had suggested. Honestly, times have changed, the official said. The party has changed. Marco has evolved. The president has evolved the other way. So by the time they got together in January, there really wasn't much of a gap. And there's no question in Marco's mind about who's in charge. The desire to have a steady hand running foreign policy meant that getting him through the Senate would be easy. The White House understood that there wasn't going to be any opposition, Mills said. He was confirmed by a vote of 99-0. Still, Rubio sometimes had to contort himself to meet the realities of Trump's second term. Not long after taking office, he visited the American Embassy in Guatemala City to discuss painful news. The U.S. had been spending about $200 million a year to bolster Guatemala's government and economy, in part to relieve the surge of migrants to the U.S. Now those initiatives were imperiled. Soon after taking office, Trump had signed an executive order freezing foreign assistance and had placed some 10,000 aid workers on leave. Days before Rubio's visit, Elon Musk, the tech mogul charged with slashing government spending, had declared that the U.S. Agency for International Development would be abolished and its surviving functions overseen by an office in the State Department. Aid to Guatemala would be cut nearly 40%. At the embassy, Rubio spoke to staffers in the courtyard and could do little more than try to offer reassurance. According to a person familiar with the discussion, he said that he hadn't known that there would be aid cuts when he agreed to become secretary, and that he didn't like them. Though he acknowledged that there would be changes to eliminate waste at USAID, he said that assistance would remain robust. Rubio's message was he didn't know about the cuts, didn't sign off on them, and that he'd fight to restore them, an American official who saw the address said. A few weeks later, Rubio told a different story. Testifying before the Senate Appropriations Committee, he claimed that he'd made the cuts himself. The DOGE team didn't do anything, Rubio said. I did it. I was the one who made the decisions. I remember being in a hotel, I believe in Guatemala, going through line by line on spreadsheets of contracts that were canceled. Afterwards, Rubio changed his story yet again. In private meetings, he assured senators that he would try to reverse the cuts. My impression was that he didn't have much power, a source on Capitol Hill told me. As Rubio entered the State Department, a contingent was gathering there to carry out Trump's agenda. A core group of influential supporters came from the Ben Franklin Fellowship, a network of conservative foreign policy thinkers that seeks to reshape American diplomacy, much as the Federalist Society has reshaped the courts. The group, including Christopher Landau, who became deputy secretary, espoused a stringent resistance to unlimited interventions abroad. It was also determined to change the way that employees were hired and promoted. The fellowship's members were mostly white men, and many of them argue that the department under Biden had privileged minority and female candidates. Simon Hankinson, a former Foreign Service officer who is now a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, told me, "We had 250 years of racism in this country, and the Biden administration decided that the only way to reverse that was with more racism." Hankinson said that the left-wing ethos extended to installing Black Lives Matters and gay pride flags at U.S. embassies, even in conservative countries. "Flying a gay pride flag doesn't go down well in East Africa," he said. The European foreign minister suggested that, amid the fervor of cost-cutting, Rubio had quietly worked to limit the damage. "He has protected, I think, sensible people at the State Department, and he has a couple of Trumpian commissars watching him at all times." The minister explained that the White House had placed loyalists at the department. "Marco's got people around him who he clearly didn't pick and who keep an eye on him." To help run the department, Rubio brought his two closest allies from his Senate office, Mike Needham and Dan Holler. Both were former longtime employees of the Heritage Foundation. Heritage rose to prominence in the 1980s as a think tank promoting small government at home and anti-communism abroad. Since Trump's first election, though, it had aligned itself more overtly with his views, sometimes taking a Christian nationalist tone. A scholar who recently resigned from Heritage told me, "These are people who think Vladimir Putin is the savior of Christendom and the white race." Although Rubio never espoused anything like that in public, some of the new arrivals at State did. One of them was Darren Beatty, the acting Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy. Beatty, who has a PhD in political theory from Duke, was a speechwriter for Trump during his first term until he was fired after speaking at an event attended by white nationalists. Out of the government, he was routinely wrote racist and authoritarian missives on social media. A month before Trump's victory in 2024, he posted, "Competent white men must be in charge if you want things to work. Unfortunately, our entire national ideology is predicated on coddling the feelings of women and minorities and demoralizing competent white men. Beatty told me that he had not intended the post to be read literally. I approached Twitter in a provocative and sometimes hyperbolic manner to make an underlying point, he said. Beatty is still at the State Department and also presides over the recently renamed Donald J. Trump Institute of Peace. The State Department released pronouncements unlike anything that had come from there before. In May, Samuel Sampson, a 27-year-old senior policy advisor, published an article titled The Need for Civilization Allies in Europe on the department's Substack. In it, he claimed that elites were conspiring to destroy Europe's ancestral heritage. The global liberal project is trampling democracy and Western heritage along with it in the name of a decadent governing class afraid of its own people. Much of the America First agenda is predicated on the idea that European culture is threatened in both Europe and the U.S. The White House's newest national security strategy warned that Europe, amid waves of unrestrained immigration, faced civilization erasure. Even Rubio put out memos that would previously have been inconceivable. In April, an order was sent in his name to embassies around the world urging employees to report colleagues for anti-Christian bias. The memo specified that reports should be as detailed as possible, including names, dates, locations. Violators would be disciplined, it noted. Another memo informed diplomats that they would be rewarded for fidelity to the secretary, that is, to Rubio. At times, the department seemed as if it were in the throes of a revolution. It felt like year zero when the Khmer Rouge took over. Anything that came before 2025 should be purged, a former longtime diplomat told me. In the weeks after Trump's inauguration, new political appointees gathered for meetings from which career diplomats were excluded by some accounts. IDs were checked at the door. The appointees competed to demonstrate loyalist zeal. There is an outer circle of MAGA people who are desperate to show that they're part of the team, so they overcompensate, the former diplomat said. On a trip to Europe to discuss aid programs in Afghanistan, a new Trump appointee announced to officials from some 30 countries that the U.S. would no longer take part. When the officials looked stunned, the MAGA appointee shut them down. "We're not going to be repeating the failures of the past 4 years," she said. Despite Trump's rhetoric around avoiding foreign entanglements, he has intervened indiscriminately around the globe. He ordered the destruction of Iran's key nuclear facilities, loosing a stream of 30,000-pound bombs, something presidents before him had threatened but never done. He shipped immense numbers of sophisticated weapons to Israel, even as those weapons were deployed to kill tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians. He imposed steep tariffs on India, one of America's most important allies, for buying Russian oil, but refrained from imposing them on China, which buys far more. He has made common cause with Christians in Nigeria and spun up a phony genocide of white farmers in South Africa. With Trump, you have to resist the temptation to intellectualize what he is doing, a former National Security Council staffer told me. Their emotional responses flying all over the place. In January, during one of Rubio's first visits to the Oval Office as secretary, Trump picked up the phone and called Laura Loomer, the right-wing influencer. Loomer had visited Panama to film migrants passing through the Darien Gap on their way to the U.S., and also to document what she described as a Chinese takeover of the canal zone. Trump had posted some of Loomer's footage on his Truth Social account and threatened to seize the canal, prompting Panamanians to burn effigies of him. During the call in the Oval Office, he said, "Laura, send Marco all your reports." Rubio flew to Panama a few days later. In the capital, he met with Panamanian President Jose Raul Moreno. The men entered a negotiating room stone-faced. In the following months, Rubio emerged as one of the main enforcers of the president's immigration crackdown. After leaving Panama, he visited El Salvador, where he made a deal with Nayib Bukele, the populist president to accept about 250 Venezuelan immigrants into a fearsome maximum security prison called CECOT. Bukele has disregarded due process and repealed term limits in El Salvador, according to Human Rights Watch. Prisoners at CECOT are routinely tortured. The Trump administration alleged that the deportees were gang members and drug traffickers, although many did not have criminal records. The immigrants did not receive trials or deportation hearings. Trump removed them under the Alien Enemies Act, which gives the president enhanced powers in wartime. Court challenges ensued. In exchange for Bukele's cooperation, the U.S. paid his government about $5 million. During a signing ceremony, Rubio called the deal the most unprecedented, extraordinary migratory agreement anywhere in the world. Rubio has also used visas as a weapon against what the administration regards as hostile elements. Since taking office, he has revoked the visas of at least 85,000 people, many of them students at American universities, on the ground that they pose a threat to the citizens, culture, government, institutions, or founding principles of the United States. The revocations punish not just actions, but also speeches, articles, and Facebook musings. In March, Rubio ordered American diplomats to scour the social media posts of people who had applied for student visas. That month, Rumeysa Ortaçtuk, a Turkish graduate student studying at Tufts University, was walking down a street in Massachusetts when she was seized by masked immigration agents, thrown into a van, and sent to a detention center in Louisiana. No charges were made public, but her supporters say that her offense was co-writing an op-ed supporting divestment from Israel. She was held for 6 weeks. Her case is still unresolved. Trump's critics, including the president of Colombia and the former presidents of Costa Rica and Panama, were also prevented from entering the country. Rubio barred judges from the International Criminal Court after they condemned Israel's conduct in the war in Gaza, and he threatened to keep out foreigners who criticized Charlie Kirk, the assassinated pro-Trump commentator. He even paused visas for thousands of truck drivers, who are mostly from Mexico, warning that the increasing number of foreign drivers operating large tractor-trailer trucks on U.S. roads is endangering American lives. One exception he made was for athletes. A team from Venezuela was allowed to attend the Little League World Series. After taking over the State Department, Rubio fired some 250 diplomats and about 1,000 civil service employees. The raw number, about 7% of the department's U.S.-based staff, was not necessarily catastrophic. Even with the reductions, the department was above its pre-pandemic level of employment. But the positions that were eliminated suggested a blunt, even indiscriminate approach. Entire offices were closed or gutted, including the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, the Bureau of Cyberspace and Digital Policy, and the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations, which dispatched officers to countries emerging from civil war. Nowhere was the diminishment of America's global ambitions more evident than in the dismantling of USAID. Before Trump returned to office, the agency had distributed about $40 billion a year to support a vast array of initiatives, ranging from food assistance to training police to combat drug trafficking. The new administration quickly eliminated 90% of the agency's staff. Rubio announced that he would cut more than 80% of its programs and approved sharp reductions to efforts that tracked human rights abuses and provided health care, including for people with HIV. The cuts baffled some experts, especially given that the programs totaled less than 1% of the federal budget. Richard Fontaine, an NSCA during George W. Bush's presidency, predicted that the administration would come to regret its choices. One day they're going to wake up and decide that they don't want to bomb people, that they want to try something other than military, he told me, and many of the soft power tools they once had are going to be gone. Jeremy Lewin, a former DOGE operative who helped restructure the State Department after the cuts, argued that USAID had become a corrupt, inefficient, and consultant-driven bureaucracy that rewarded a well-paid administrative class at the expense of the American people. "There's a ton of waste," he told me. "You had all these left-wing organizations paying their CEOs millions of dollars. It became a cottage industry." Lewin said that the USAID had pushed human rights and democracy programs indiscriminately in a way that alienated allies. The idea was, we're going to have a bunch of civil servants doing democracy promotion, civil liberties, and whatever, running multilateral institutions, he said. We're going to bring all these authoritarian countries together and liberalize them. That has demonstrably failed, of course, and now we see the rise of non-democratic countries all around the world, the rise of China. Yet the cuts to foreign aid have undermined American influence across the globe, even as the U.S. is struggling to compete with China. Experts are concerned about China's domination of the world market for rare earth minerals, which are essential to the equipment that powers much of modern life. Many crucial sources are found in Africa and Asia. Tom Shannon, the former undersecretary, explained, "The battle for technological superiority and economic dominance is going to be built through the markets and the resources of the global South. Why would you take the one instrument that you have that connects you to all the global South countries, and not just the governments, but to peoples and societies, and blow it up? In addition to foreign aid, you need a really competent, capable diplomatic corps that can walk around the world for you and help secure these relationships," Shannon argued. "Access to resources and markets can no longer be assured through colonialism. You can't just go in and capture large swaths of the world and force these countries to hand over their minerals. The competition is going to be ferocious." Indeed, in many places where the United States has diminished its presence, China has already moved in. During the Cold War, Radio Free Europe broadcast news to parts of Eastern Europe that were under communist dominion. In modern-day counterpart, Radio Free Asia built an estimated weekly audience of 58 million people in 15 languages, employing reporters to dig up news in places where free expression is ruthlessly suppressed. In 2017, a Radio Free Asia reporter named Shohurt Hashir broke the story that the Chinese government was holding members of the fiercely oppressed Uyghur minority in concentration camps in Xinjiang. The story caused a sensation. After it emerged that inmates were being forced into slave labor, Rubio co-authored a bill in the Senate banning imports from the region. In 2020, Radio Free Asia revealed that China was covering up deaths from COVID-19. When the cuts went into effect, the network lost 90% of its staff, including nearly all the reporters. Bei Fang, the president and CEO, told me, "The Chinese picked up right where we left off." After Radio Free Asia was forced to give up the 60-plus frequencies it broadcast on, China's government began using many of them to reach its former audience. When USAID was dismantled, Senator Jean Shaheen, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, dispatched staff members to assess the impact in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The results, published in a 91-page report, make for sobering reading. The report details dozens of defunct programs in places where America is struggling to secure its interests. One was in sub-Saharan Africa, where the U.S. has backed a $500 million loan and $20 million in grants to develop a rail line that would move valuable minerals from Zambia and the Democratic Republic of Congo to a port on the Atlantic Ocean. The project has attracted hundreds of millions of dollars in additional investments. It was halted for almost all of 2025. China, meanwhile, continued building its own billion-dollar railway from Zambia to the opposite coast. The Chinese didn't stop. They're going to move the minerals straight to China, a committee staffer who visited the region told me. Lewin suggested that America could maintain its influence by directly cultivating national leaders. What Secretary Rubio is doing, he's making a department that actually works in this new era of great power competition, he said. The State Department would still promote democracy, but mostly in hostile places such as Cuba and Venezuela, not in countries that are friendly to the U.S., no matter how autocratic they are. Much of the money from canceled programs could be dispersed according to the desires of Rubio and Trump rather than those of the State Department or aid groups, or those of Congress, which has legal authority over such funding. Lewin offered another example. In September, the Philippine President Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos visited Washington, and Rubio decided to give his country $250 million in public health aid. The State Department provided few details about the Philippines' grant or any other new program, not to the press, to the public, nor to Congress, despite the fact that these disclosures are required by law. The committee staffer told me, "We've asked for information and we've gotten almost nothing. The State Department says that it has fully complied with the law. Periodically, the administration announces new initiatives by press release. In Africa, it has pledged billions of dollars to deeply corrupt governments in Kenya, Liberia, and Uganda, claiming that the grants will encourage self-sufficiency. But without American aid workers overseeing programs, it's not clear how the new system will ensure that money isn't wasted or stolen." As a senator, Rubio made both moral and tactical arguments for helping other countries. "We don't have to give foreign aid. We do so because it furthers our national interest," he said in a speech in 2013. Rubio sat on the board of the International Republican Institute, which provided training to fledgling democracies, teaching candidates how to campaign, and poll watchers how to observe elections. The Institute operated in more than 100 countries, including Cuba, where it supported dissidents facing down the communist government. In the current round of cuts, the IRI lost more than half its budget and it's furloughed 2/3 of its staff. And that's all we have time for today. Dextra Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Forever War, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.